We laugh at something like that because he just doesn't fully understand what he's done. Yet in reality, that's the truth about all of us when it comes to our mess. We never fully understand exactly what it is we've done. And we look at a situation like that, it's funny because he doesn't fully get it. He's made a lot of dumb mistakes, and he doesn't really know how to deal with it or what to say about it. And we laugh about it, but the reality is that's us. And all of us have these things that happen in life where eventually the mess of life catches up with us. I think there's kind of three phases we go through. Phase one is where you realize you can't cover it up anymore. You get to that point. In high school, it's when you're driving dad's car and you put a dent in it and you realize that's not going to buff out. Eventually, that's going to be seen. There's no way to hide that. You're going to have to fess up and say what it is that happened. You're just trying to figure out how to do it. Other times, the secrecy has, you know, been kept under wraps until now, but all of a sudden you begin to realize that the circle of secrecy is growing so big that there's just no way to keep it quiet any longer. Eventually, it's going to come out, and eventually everybody's going to find out about it. The utilities get disconnected, and you get a call from your wife and saying, is there something going on financially I don't know about? You begin to realize in that moment, the cat's out of the bag. You can't keep this quiet any longer. The reality is we all try to keep everything that we're doing wrong or that we don't want anybody to know about. We keep it under wraps, and we do a really good job of it. We cover up our sin really, really well. Well, we cover up our shortcomings really, really well, almost to the point where we've convinced ourselves we aren't really all that bad. And then the second phase that comes in is you realize that you have been trying to fool everybody else, but truly the only person you've really, really fooled all along is yourself. Because you've gotten yourself to the point where, this is kind of the crazy thing, you start off knowing you're doing something wrong, but eventually you get so good at hiding it and covering up and nobody else knows you're doing anything wrong, that eventually you begin to act like you're not doing anything wrong. And you begin to judge other people who are doing the very same thing that you're doing. Or sometimes you judge other people. This happens in church the most. The reality is most sin can be covered up, right? But some can't. And woe to you if your sin can't be covered up, right? I mean, after all, let's face it, heterosexual sins are easier to cover up than homosexual sins. Is that a fair statement? Private sins that we do in our own home are a lot easier to cover up than public ones. Pornography is easier to cover up than an affair. You can cover up an affair, but pornography is a heck of a lot easier to cover up. Drugs and alcohol, much easier to cover up than food issues, right? Just by the very nature of it, there's certain things that you can cover up. And when you can cover up your sin well, it sort of gives you this ability, this idea in your mind that I can judge other people for what they're doing. If for no other reason than the fact that it makes me feel better about myself, because I can walk around with sort of an air of superiority about myself. Or it happens in marriages, right? Because I look at my spouse and I think to myself, well, I know I'm the better of the two of us. Now, you wouldn't say that, but in the back of mind, you're thinking it. Why? Because you know all the chores you're doing, and you know all the chores they're not doing. You have no idea what they're doing when you're not around or not looking. But you just assume you're the one doing most of the stuff. And since you've covered up all of your faults and all of your failures, since you're the one who handles the finances so nobody sees how you're spending money, you're able to get on everybody else for what they spend money on, but nobody knows what you're doing. The more you can cover up, the more you end up fooling yourselves. But at some point, when you realize the gig is up, there's that sinking feeling that sets in that all the stuff I've been doing and all the stuff I've been telling myself is a lie. And you have to look yourself in the mirror and you realize, I've messed up. And we like that word messed up better because it's a lot better than saying, I'm a liar. I'm an adulterer. I'm a cheater. I'm a thief. We just like saying, I messed up. I messed up. And then there's the third phase, and that's where you actually have to have that confrontation. You actually have to look at somebody and say, I messed up. I'm not who you thought I was. I haven't been honest with you. I haven't been faithful. I was careless. Something happened tonight and I messed up the car. And that's a hard thing because you don't know how the person's going to react, right? I mean, it was hard enough to face the facts myself. It's even harder when I don't know what that reaction's going to be. And sometimes when you're a kid, you work through all the scenarios, like, what's the worst that can happen? What can dad do? Well, he can't legally kill me. I know he won't. He's going to probably take everything away from me. And so then you start trying to fix whatever you can before that happens. Or with the marriage, you go through all the same scenarios of what's going to happen. You get on the worst case scenarios. similar kind of thing happens, of course, in our relationship with God. And this is something that Jesus is trying to explain or summarize in one of the most famous stories we'll read about in the Bible. It's so famous that it's quoted in movies like Rocky, Iron Man, Blade Runner, Toy Story. All those stories talk about this one story that Jesus tells long ago. Some of you are thinking, I thought I knew what it was, but I didn't realize all those. Of course, it's a story we know as the prodigal son. It's a story of two sons, of two brothers. It's a story of a father. And just Jesus goes around, this is in Luke chapter 15, as he begins to tell a story, he tells a story of a son who wants nothing to do with his dad. He just says, you know, I wish I could live my own life. I wish I could do my own things. And what's really holding me back is this family and the rules and the structure and the environment of it. If I could just do my own thing and be my own person, I could be a success. I could really do something with my life. And really, basically, what I want from you, Dad, is I want all the good stuff. I just don't want you. And in reality, that is humanity. We want every good thing that God gives us. We just don't want to have a relationship with God. We certainly don't want his rules. I mean, because that just doesn't seem like any fun in life. And I could certainly do more, experience more, and get more out of life if I went outside of God's. It seems like as if God's ever so restrictive. It seems like everything God wants you to do, it's like all the fun stuff God tells you no. Isn't that how it starts off when you're a kid, right? All the fun stuff God's going to tell you no. And so eventually you begin to realize, and it gets driven in your head, that if God says to do it, it's probably not good for you. It's probably not fun. And so you begin to think that there's a life out there that's going to be so much better than a life with God. And so what you want to do is you want to be able to enjoy all the good. And you never really think about the fact that every good thing you've ever experienced in this life comes from him. Every good thing you've ever experienced all comes from the Creator. And you want to walk away from the Creator, the one who supplied everything, and just say, give me all your stuff, I'm out of here, I want to do my own thing, because life would be a lot better without you. And so that's the story Jesus begins to tell in Luke chapter 15. And when you pick up the story kind of in the midpoint of it, it goes everywhere you think it ultimately would, everywhere it always does in our life. We end up making a mess of things. You give me enough freedom, eventually I'll make a mess of it, right? Sometimes people say, I want to give you just enough rope to what? You already know, you already been there, right? That's what freedom is, give you just enough rope to hang yourself. Employers do this with employees just so they can rein them in. Parents do this with their kids. You give them just enough rope so they can, we don't want them to completely hang themselves. We want to come in and cut the rope at just the right time. We want to give you just enough rope to realize you're going to make a mess of it if you do things on your own, and that's what happens with the guy in the story. He eventually makes a mess of his life, and of course Jesus illustrates this by simply saying he ends up in a pig pen. And he's there feeding the pigs. And before long, he's not just feeding the pigs, he's feeding alongside the pigs. And if that hasn't been your experience yet in life, either you're too dumb to realize it, or it just hasn't happened yet. Because eventually, that's where all of our lives go outside of God. We end up making a mess of it. We think we can do finances without God. We think we can do marriage without God. We think we can do parenting without God. And eventually, we make a mess of it. And we try to fix it. We put the bag over at the car window. And we pull around. I was thinking on my feet. I was fixing it. And we have to at some point confess we've messed up. We've done something wrong. We made a mess of our life. And so when it says here in the story, it says, when he gets to this point and phase one hits him that he's made a mess of his life, he quickly moves to phase two where it says, and he came to his senses. He came to his senses. What he's saying there is for the first time you can see clearly who you really are. Up until now, you've been able to fool yourself, you've been able to fool everybody else around you, and you've been lulled into this idea that everything is going to be fine, everything's going to work out just the way I want, it's all going to be great. And when you come to your senses, that's when you move out of dreamland and you move into reality. My actions have consequences. The lies eventually come out. Eventually, you have to pay the bills. You can't keep putting it off forever and ever and ever. Eventually, it's all going to come out. And it says he came to his senses. And he said, man, how many of my father's servants even have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I'll set out, I'll go back to my father, and I'll say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants. You know, it's funny. It's like he comes to his senses, but he's still operating, if you notice, on the same basis as when he left. And that's the hard thing to realize, is he's come to his senses, but he hasn't fully come to a sense of reality. If you notice, he says in there, I'll go back. I could be like a hired servant. I could earn my way back into my father's good graces. And the whole idea from the start is he left the house thinking that if I could do things on my own, if I could do things my way, then I could show everybody who I am and the success I am, and I could be a lot better off in life if I just did my own thing. And so even when he comes to his senses on his own, he's still thinking to himself, I'm going to earn my way back in. I'm going to make up for it. And that's what you do when you're driving the car home, isn't it? I'll make up for it. I'll work it off. That's what you're doing before you make the confession is, honey, I'll make it up to you. I'll work overtime. I'll show you how much I love you this time. And you're always thinking of how you can work off, because the one thing you never expect, the one thing you never bank on, the one thing you know isn't going to happen is a word that's only found in church and we still don't understand the meaning of it, and that's grace. We never expect grace. We never count on grace. We never factor in grace, because we don't even think grace is possible. And so he says, how many of my father's servants are better in the situation I'm in? So I'll go to my father and I'll say, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Say that for me. Just look to the person next to you and say, look him right in the eye and say, I have sinned. I have sinned. Look at him and say, I'm a sinner. I'll explain more on the way home. It's a weird thing to say, right? And before you go to think, like, okay, so even if you don't agree with God's standards, okay, even if by God's standards, you know, like, well, I don't know if I'm a sinner, you know, I don't know if I believe in all God's standards, even by your own standards, can you even keep your own? I mean, who in here doesn't abhor liars? I've got no place for liars, yet at the same time, we all know I'm a liar. You know, we'll be willing to gossip about somebody else's relationship desires and how they've, you know, gotten out of control. Yet at the same time, we don't like gossips and we know that we haven't been able to control our own desires. We can't even keep our own standards, let alone God's. So clearly we are. But he does come out and say, I'm a sinner. And I like this next line. He says, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Like you ever were. See, this... Every time I hire one of my boys to work around the house or do something, this always comes out. We negotiate how much to pay, right? And it's really interesting to hear what my kids think they're worth, right? Right? Oh, come on, seriously, Dad, you know, $20 an hour minimum, right? I mean, come on, you know? This job right here, you should be happy to have. Why? Because I already live here, right? You don't have to wait for me to show up for work. I'm already here, right? You know? And you don't got to worry about downtime. If you're not keeping me busy, I got my phone right here. I can get on that anytime. You don't got to worry about that. You don't got to worry about me. If there's something you haven't told me to do, I'll be fine. I won't complain about not having to work. I'll just get on my phone. It's all right. It's all good, Dad. Right? And, you know, let's see. I woke up at 10 o'clock, so I think that's when I clocked in. You didn't even finish breakfast and get dressed till 11. Yeah, but you got me up early. Oh, okay. And on and on and on we go of what they're worth. Okay. Do they ever realize that every dollar I give them is grace? No, because it's all about what I'm worth. And how hard I'm working. Yes, you are unskilled, untrained, uneducated, unmotivated. I could keep on going with all of the uns. Unintelligent, uninspired labor. That's what you are, okay? You are worth less than minimum wage, in my opinion, right? Less than minimum wage. At least if I hired somebody minimum wage, I could be harsh with them and demand they work and fire them. You, I can't seem to fire you. I still have to feed you even if I fire you, right? And eventually, this is the conundrum you face as parents. If you don't make them work for the money, eventually you have to pay for the shoes yourself. Right? Like, as if my kids are broke, I'm not going to make them go without shoes. But if they have money, they can buy their own, right? So even if they fire them, it's like they just go on workman's comp or welfare, right? And yet it's all about what they're worth. And so here's this kid in the pig slop thinking to himself, well, I'm no longer worthy of the $20 an hour I used to make. No, I can come in for what the servants make now because I'm no longer worthy because of what I've done. I've messed up. I'll have to earn it back in. You see, even when he comes to his senses, he still doesn't fully realize who he is and the situation he's in. And I think the same is true with us. Even when we think we've come to our senses and we recognize our sin before God, we still don't fully realize just really where we're at. We're still kind of expecting the $20 an hour. We're still just assuming we're going to get the job. You see, that's the other thing about him. He says, I'll go back home because I know my dad's going to hire me. Why? Why should he? Why should he? After what you did and the way you acted, why should God continue to extend you any grace whatsoever? Yet still there's always this sort of subtle arrogance that we just can't seem to shake or get rid of. And the issue, the problem with that is when you still have some sense of that, you don't fully understand grace. Even when he's feeding pigs, even when he realizes he's sinned, he's no longer worthy to be called a son, even then he still doesn't really fully realize just really where he's at. In that day, in that society, what would typically happen if a son had done this to his parents in an honor-shame society, in one in which you have shamed the name of your family? To have a son go and do something like this would be disgraceful, not just to the son. We think individualistically, like the son's made a mess of his life. No, this has made a mess of the family's life. If you've ever had somebody who's done something publicly to destroy your company, you realize it doesn't just impact them, it impacts the entire company. You know, it's one of the great worries any church has. You know, if somebody were to do something to a child, it doesn't just impact the person who did it and the family that it happened to, right? It impacts the reputation of the whole. You know, we can understand that in certain situations in our own culture that sometimes the sin of one is a shame felt by the entire community, right? And in their culture, that's exactly what would happen. When this son has done this, the shame that it would bring to the father, to the family, it would have that same sort of aura around it, like, what kind of dad would raise a son that would do something like that? What's going on in that home? What kind of father would even allow that kind of thing to happen? What a messed up family. Every other family in town probably felt better about them, you know, just by, you know, looking at their situation. And so he thinks to himself, well, certainly I'll get the job. In reality, what would typically happen is he would be beaten back out of town. You know, they would literally beat him, you know, basically two choices. Either you leave town once and for all, or you're going to die if you come back in. That's typically what would happen. That would be what would be expected. And yet here in his mind, he's thinking, well, you know, certainly my dad will rehire me. You know, make me like one of your hired servants, then I can pay you back what it is I've taken. What has he taken? He's taken a third of the family's estate. He's taken a third of everything the father has. He's taken a third of what has taken the father a lifetime to acquire. One of the problems kids always have is they always assume that you got everything you have overnight, right? It took you a lifetime. Like, they didn't see the fact that I used to live in a trailer. They didn't see my first apartment. They didn't see that the very first bookcase I built was in my living room floor with my wife worried that I was going to get, you know, mess up the carpet and the stain and not get our security deposit back. They didn't see any of that stuff. They look at the tools in my old tool bin. They don't know I bought those at a pawn shop because those are the only tools I could afford. They don't know any of that stuff. You know, they just come home from college and go, Dad, can I take your DeWalt? No, you can take the Black & Decker. What is that? It's the same company, just under a different name. It actually is. And so I told him the story. He's like, no, those are the tools I bought from the pawn shop. He's looking at me like, pawn shop? You mean like Pawn Stars? Yeah. Dad was broke, like you are now. Those tools fit you, right? You know, he has no concept of what it takes to get to, you know, where his father is. And he's thinking to himself, you know, in no time at all, I'll work this debt off. I'll work my way back in. And he still has no clue. So he sets out on the journey. And he's rehearsing the speech. It says, so he got up and he went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, His father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. And he ran to his son, he threw his arms around him and he kissed him. And the son said to him, just like he rehearsed, "Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son." And right as he says, "I'm no longer worthy to be called your son," the father interrupts him right then and right there. Because whatever you have to say after that is irrelevant, inconsequential. The reality of sonship is that you are never worthy of it. You just are. The idea that you can be worthy of being a son and unworthy of being a son. Son, you were never worth $20 an hour. I gave it to you because I wanted to bless you and because I love you. You were never worth the second and third and fourth, and I lost track of how many chances. The only times I've really done the 70 times 7 thing, or 7 times 70, whatever it is that Jesus talks about in forgiveness, the only time I've ever really done that is with my family. Is that a fair statement? I mean, if there's anybody who's gotten the 70 times 7, if you don't know, there's a passage in Scripture where Peter's talking to Jesus, and he says, "Hey, how many times should we forgive somebody? You know what, should we do like 7 times?" And Jesus is like, "How about 70 times 7? Like, in other words, to the point where you lose track of it, and you lose track of how many times you forgive your kids, do you not? You keep records of your wife, but you lose track with the kids. I don't know why that is, but you lose track of that with the kids. And you've forgiven them 1,000 times over. And so then this time when they come in and say, "Dad, I've totally blown it. You don't understand. I'm no longer worthy to be your son." What did that ever have to do with any of it? You never earned my love. It was just yours from the start. So he says, but the father says to the servants, "Quick, bring the best robe, put it on him, put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For the son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and he is found." And they all began to celebrate. Instead of coming back and being one of the servants, he's now surrounded by all of the servants of the household. And he's once again brought back in and being treated like a son as though he'd never left. I don't know if we'll ever fully understand the grace that God's extended us. But let's move on in the story. It says, but then the older brother was out in the fields, and he hears the commotion inside. And he comes up to the house, and he asks one of the servants, "What's going on? What's all the commotion about?" He says, "Oh, your brother's returned. He's come home. Your father's killed the fatted calf. We're having a party to celebrate. We're just so happy to have him home." And the brother's, I'm sure he's asking questions like, "Well, did he return the money? Did he bring that back?" No, Dad's just happy to have him home. He looked like he was messed up. He smelled like pigs. And we're doing what now? And he refuses to go in to celebrate. So the father comes out to him and says, "Come on in." He's like, "Dad, I don't know, I don't get this. You know, this son of yours, not my brother, this son of yours goes off and does this, and yet you welcome him right back in. He squandered all your money on prostitutes and wild living." It's so funny. People always talk about the prodigal son going off and spending his money on prostitutes. We don't ever know if he does that or not. The only person who says that's the older brother, right? The person just, you know, he could just be making stuff up for all we know. We don't know. He says, you know, he squandered everything. And yet you welcome him. You don't ever do anything like that for me. What do I get for all the work I'm doing around here? I'm worth it. I deserve it. I'm getting paid the $20 an hour because I'm worth $20 an hour. And you see, we laughed about it earlier, but the older brother still thinks he's worth the $20 an hour. He still thinks he's better than everybody else on the farm. He still thinks he's better than the other servants. He still has that mentality about him. So he refuses to go in. And the story just ends with this open-ended invitation of, "Will you come back in?" Now, the genius in the story is all of us can find ourselves somewhere in this story. For years, at least in your early part of your relationship with God, you might think of yourself as that prodigal because you remember that time when you were in that place. The reality, though, is the longer you're in church, the more you become the older brother. The more you begin to cover up your own sins and be able to point out the others. Because let's face it, if somebody shows up with the prostitute, you're feeling pretty good about yourself, right? At least I'm not that, right? I mean, let's face it, there's some couples you like hanging out with because then you can go home and say, honey, I'm not that bad. I mean, come on, seriously, right? There's some people you can be around that just make you feel better about yourself, right? Because the comparison is easy. And so for the older brother, he's thinking that very same thing. Now, what's hidden in this whole story are a couple things. One is a cultural thing, and the other is just a hidden part of the biblical narrative, and they both go together. The cultural thing is this. It was the role of the older brother. The older brother ultimately would be given a double share of the inheritance. As such, it was the brother's role to sort of be the... he's the future of the family. You know, while it's the father's job to raise the children and he's the current patriarch, the future of the family lies in the brother's hands. And the brother has some sense of responsibility that's supposed to be about him to care for the family in the same way the father cares for the family. You know, just in some way, shape, or form, play some role in caring for the younger brother who has wandered off, to perhaps be the one to go and look, to be the one to go and help, be the one who can be a guide. I mean, one of the first questions that God asks in Scripture to Cain when he's dealing with Cain and Abel is what? Where's your brother? And what's he say back? Am I my brother's keeper? It's the same attitude of the older brother. What, is his problem my problem? His problem's not my problem. His problem's his problem. It's not my problem. So that's the first thing you need to know. The second thing about the story is, why is it that the father could invite the younger son back in? It's because ultimately the father is the one who absorbs the debt. And who's the person who's telling the story? Jesus. And who is Jesus in the story? We want to say he's the father. Well, no, he's not the father. Because we know there's God the Father and there's God the Son. Who is Jesus in the story? Jesus is the older brother that you have. We're told the story about the older brother that the prodigal has. But in the story, you need to realize Jesus is the older brother that you have. For God so loved you that he gave his one and only son, that whoever would have a relationship with him would not perish but have everlasting life. Ultimately, he is the one who takes your place. On the cross, what does he say? My God, why have you forsaken me? He's the one who's ultimately cast out of the Father's presence. Why? So you, the younger brother, can be brought back in. And that's the piece of story that we miss. It's a beautiful thing when grace takes over your heart. It's a beautiful thing when you finally realize and accept grace for what it is. When you move through all of the, well, I'm not worthy, but I could be worthy, but I used to be worthy, but I'm not anymore, and you get rid of the whole concept of worthy because sonship and you know the parent-child relationship has never been about the worthiness at all. It's all about one thing and one thing only, and that's the father's love for the child, and that's it. That's it. And God's hope for a church would be that it would be a community of older brothers like the true older brother in the story, which is Jesus. It'd be a community where grace abounds. We live in a life where sometimes we judge God and we think to ourselves, you know, I wish God would fix everything around us in the world. And he's looking at you and me and saying, if you would be like the true older brother in the story, not the one you read about, because who he's calling out in this whole story is the religious types. Or the older brother who doesn't care about the world. He says, but if you would be like the older brother that is the true son, it would change this world. I want to try something to see if you can experience what I'm talking about. You're on a praise team, right? Yeah. Could you hum for us in a way everybody could hear Amazing Grace? Nobody else hum. Nobody else, just her. Go, keep going. All right, now will you touch somebody next to you? And if you've been touched, start to hum as well. You can touch as many as you like. Go ahead. All right, go ahead. Keep going. Keep going. Keep going. You got to keep humming, though. And if you've been touched, you can touch. Grace seems to be spreading this way, but not so much this way. Keep going as I talk. Some of you probably have been sitting there wondering, when is the grace ever going to get to me? When's it going to come my way? This is what a world is desperately wanting to know from you. When is the grace that you have going to come their way? When can I join in the beauty of what I hear and what I experience? When can I sing the song of grace in my own life? Is there anybody who hasn't received the grace yet? Just raise your hand if you haven't. God's vision for this city is eventually there would be no hand that would ever go up that hasn't heard of and received and understood the grace that he shared with us. That's the message of Easter and the message you need to take with you today. That for God so loved the world, he gave his one and only son, the true older brother, that we will never be worthy of. But he's brought us in because he considers us his own sons, his own daughters. Will you join with me as we close our time in prayer? Father, thank you for your grace, that though we're not worthy, you've loved us just the same. And Father, may we be ones who spread your grace, speak of your grace, share your grace, and show your grace. Simply because we know, Father, that's the only reason why we have a relationship with you to begin with. We will never be worthy of it. We can never earn it. It is always by 100% grace. And in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.